Sunset 5:43. Look for a clear sky and cold temperatures, a low of 35. Saturday, sunny and 60. And the rain returns on Sunday with a high of 63. Right now, wind has calmed down. It's northwest at 9. Sunny and 40 degrees in Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today. The first concerns the current production at the Racine Theater Guild of the great American classic Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. Part two is about a big anniversary occurring at one of Kenosha's largest churches, St. Mary's Lutheran Church, celebrating its 150th anniversary with a gala concert this coming Sunday. Here's part one. I'm always happy when I have the opportunity to reconnect with Lisa Kornetsky. Our legacy together in terms of morning show conversations extends back into the early 1990s, I think, during her first stint as a member of the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. She left Parkside for a time to take some kind of position, I believe, in Madison, and then returned to Parkside for more years of distinguished service, and now is enjoying happy retirement, but not entirely disconnected from the world of theater. In fact, far from it. And in fact, recently has served as guest conductor at the Racine Theater Guild for their production of a stage adaptation of Louisa May Alcott's classic Little Women. This is a production that has just opened at the Theater Guild, opening actually just after Lisa and I record this conversation. And it runs for the next couple of weekends at the Guild. And so you still have an opportunity to see what I have heard from various cast members to be an exceptionally fine production of one of the most beautiful works for the stage and one of the great masterworks of American literature, Little Women. Lisa Kornetsky, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Oh, thank you. It is always wonderful to be here.
You have guest directed for the Guild at least once before. Is this a trick question to ask you what you've done with them already, or is it all just a happy swirl?
No, I think I can remember that far back. In 2019, I directed Lost in Yonkers by Neil Simon. So it's been a while, but I was delighted to be asked to come back.
Great. And I imagine you were excited at the opportunity to direct a production of this great work, Little Women. In your long career, have you had any direct connection with Little Women? I mean, is it something you've ever directed before?
No, in fact, you know, it's interesting because there are so many adaptations of Little Women. There are all of the movies that people are, I'm sure, familiar with. There is an opera, there is a musical. There was long ago an adaptation for the stage, and there are many adaptations for young people. But this is the first adaptation that I'm aware of, and it's pretty new, from 2018, that is, you know, for a universal audience, not just geared towards children. So my connection to Little Women has been, you know, like so many women, particularly of my age, so many people, from my childhood, you know, reading the book and loving the book. So it was very exciting to be asked to do this particular play.
I wanted to ask you about your feelings about the original novel and the essence of this story as a woman in 2024, as a woman who cares about the place of women in American society and the way in which women are seen. How would you place, first of all, the novel in its sort of original setting, the context in which it was originally written? What do you think Little Women has to say to women in 2024?
I think that's a great question because it's very timely, although it's hard for me to imagine in the 150 plus years since the novel was written that it hasn't been timely in its depiction of the struggles that women have had in the United States and across the world. I think the essence of the book is about family and love, but also very much about people trying to find out who they are and to have the opportunities to be what they want to be, whatever that means, to have a career, to have a life, to choose the kind of life as women, particularly, and girls that they can direct themselves towards. And we know that, you know, the novel is written, takes place during the Civil War, that women had very few choices about what they could do. You could be a wife, you could be a mother, maybe you could be a teacher or a nurse. But the central character, Jo, is a writer, and she wants to write, and she wants to be independent. She doesn't want to be a wife or a mother. That's not her primary goal. And I think when we think about the opportunities for women today, we still have a glass ceiling. We still have many restrictions on things that women can do and the independence that women can have. You know, without getting political, I think we can see a world where some of that confinement on people is happening in a way that can be quite disturbing. So I think this play really allows us, and the novel certainly, to think about what happens over the ages and how certain important ideas and needs that people have haven't changed that much. So, you know, I think that's, I think it's really timely, and I think that people will really connect, both male and female, to the struggles that these characters have, particularly the central character of Jo.
Before we talk about the story, I mean, just the essence of the story, who these characters are and what happens to them, I wonder if you could speak for a moment to the whole matter of adaption, of taking a novel and adapting it for the stage. And you've already touched on the fact that Little Women has been adapted for stage and screen many times over. Maybe you could just speak for a moment generally about the challenge of effectively adapting a work that was not intended to be on the stage or screen. In fact, when this was written, there was no such thing as a screen, I guess. What is involved in effectively adapting something in that way? And are there things about this particular adaption that you think are especially effective?
I mean, what an interesting question, because I've been thinking so much about it in terms of the way that this particular script has been adapted. But I would just say, you know, when you think about a novel that is, I don't have it in front of me, but Little Women is not a short novel. You know, it's hundreds and hundreds of pages, and it covers decades of time. So you think about that, and then you think about a play that is maybe 2 hours, and how do you fit what is most important about the play and make it theatrical and interesting and exciting? What do you leave out? What do you include? So I think it's interesting, particularly in this play by Kate Hamill. So I do want to say a little bit about Kate Hamill, who is the playwright. She has a long career of adapting lots of novels. So she's done the Jane Austens and Dracula, some Greek plays, Vanity Fair. So this is kind of her thing. This is what she does besides act. And what's interesting about this adaptation is that she has not taken the whole novel. She stops the novel about 2/3 of the way through. And without giving things away, I think she does that because she really wants to focus on the younger characters and their progression to a certain point, and to really allow us to see, it's a play about a family, to see the family dynamic and not concentrate so much on what happens after a particularly important point in the novel. She also has done some really interesting things in her adaptation, because she's really looking to do a modern adaptation that really speaks to 2018 when it was written, but to the times that we're in now. So even though the play is set in the 19th century and it has period costumes, you know, it doesn't ask for us to be updating it to modern setting, it has a very contemporary feeling. And she's made lots of choices in the language. We hear characters say things that are very modern that we would never have, you know, men or women would just not have said in the 19th century. There are references to the theater. She uses vocabulary that we use in the theater today that certainly would not have been used at that time. So she's, this adaptation is really about taking the world we live in now and the novel and finding the place where those two things mesh. I think a lot of other adaptations really focus on trying to do a very accurate retelling of the novel. Both of those things are really interesting and are, from my perspective, really acceptable and exciting, because the novel will stay the same, but the way we read it, the way we think about it, changes as, you know, as time changes. Mm.
Did you choose this adaptation, or was it in effect chosen for you?
It was chosen by the Racine Theatre Guild, and I think that they were particularly interested in doing this adaptation as something that would balance out their season, and also be, you know, again, a contemporary version of a period piece.
We're speaking with Lisa Kornetsky, who is the guest director of the Racine Theatre Guild's production of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, a stage adaptation. The production opened this past weekend, and it runs the next couple of weekends on the stage of the Racine Theatre Guild. Probably before we go any further, we should give you an opportunity to outline the basic story, although it's a little hard to imagine that anybody listening doesn't have at least some acquaintance with Little Women, but it's certainly possible that there are people who have not read it in a long, long, long time, and perhaps not seen any of the film adaptions in a long, long time. So it wouldn't hurt to be reminded of at least the heart and soul of this compelling story.
So this is Louisa May Alcott wrote Little Women in the 19th century. This is a fictionalized account of her family, Louisa May Alcott's family. The play really focuses on that family, four sisters who have a very close relationship, although there is conflict, as there is in any family. It takes place during the Civil War. For the first part of the play, the father has been has volunteered as a soldier and has been fighting in the war. The mother, Marmee, is really based on Louisa May Alcott's mother, who was a social worker and worked with the poor. So it's a time when there is poverty, the family is struggling with no income, the war, you know, as we know, the Civil War was very hard on people, North or South. This play takes place in Massachusetts. And it is really about family and love and connection, but it focuses primarily on the four sisters, with Jo, the second to oldest sister, who is based on Louisa May Alcott, who is a writer and desperately wants to make her way in the world as an independent woman who can make a career and, as she says, try to change the world. So it is a pretty simple story. There are a number of struggles that the family goes through, which I don't need to mention here, but it is very much focused on, as I said, family and love and how people stay together in the worst of circumstances and find solace in the connection of family.
Hmm. I'm intrigued to think about the challenge of casting something like this. And I happen to know from inside information that you had a wealth of options to choose from in terms of a whole lot of people who auditioned for this, drawn to the project for one reason or another. I think it would be interesting as director to be casting a show in which, for instance, you want four relatively young women to be believable as four sisters, and whoever is cast as their mother, for them to seem like they are their mother. And of course, even beyond the matter of just simple physical appearance, but other matters as well, to lend authenticity to this matter of these five women being a family. How much did you think about, and what sorts of things did you look for in terms of choosing the actors whom you ultimately cast in these crucial roles?
Well, I will say, Greg, that one thing that's maybe a little different from what you just stated is that I feel, this is my personal feeling, you know, that theater is not real. We're recreating a reality. And in the world that we live in, I don't worry about a family looking like one another. You know, I think audiences can pretty quickly get past that. So that's one hurdle that I don't worry about. I think age becomes really important. And more than anything in auditions, and it was hard, we had over 65 people audition for this play in a very short time. And that made those decisions have to happen pretty quickly. But what I look for is people who have good instincts, but also who can work together. So you can have somebody who is a wonderful actor and can play a role, but you can tell sometimes in auditions that the connection between a mother and a daughter, to the sisters, there's something not there. So I really look for, how do they play off of one another? What is the connection? How open are the actors to making a subtle change? We just had wonderful people. I mean, I had way too many choices, which is a great problem to have. And ended up casting women who are young adults, who are slightly older than the women, than the young girls that they're portraying. I think that works because they can bring a depth of understanding of the journey that these characters travel on and still are certainly young enough to be believable in those roles.
What sort of experience did the people in your cast have with the novel and or the films? Did you have any people walking into this production essentially as blank slate, so to speak, or did at least most of them come with some experience with this story?
So I think that's really interesting because there are a number of actors, four or five, who are older. You know, play mother, father, other characters who are important. Those people, particularly the women, had read the novel. Not only had read the novel, but could say, "Well, in the novel, it happened. You know, this happened this way." Most of the younger women and men were very familiar with the movies, but few of them had read the book, which I think is not surprising. But the most frequent adaptation in film is the Greta Gerwig movie, which is very recent. And of course, Greta Gerwig did Barbie, well-known director. And people were very familiar with that. People were also familiar, the younger people were very familiar with the musical version of Little Women, which I have to admit I hadn't even known about. So it was very interesting to come together. I think some people would check back on in the novel, like, where did this happen? I try myself to stay away from outside, you know, particularly watching a movie that I'm directing or another production, you know, so that I don't cheat and copy and use my own vision. But I think people were pretty familiar, but it seemed generational. You know, the younger people were familiar with more, you know, media versions. And those of us who grew up with the book, I think, you know, were really focused on the novel.
I'm curious, you mentioned that the adaption makes some use of, let's say, less antiquated language. In terms of directing the production, then, are you fully embracing that? I'm curious about matters like, well, for instance, the costuming and so on, and even the way in which they sort of carry themselves, their posture, and maybe even the inflection with which they speak lines, whether they're antiquated or modern language. I mean, do you want us to feel like we are back in the 1860s, or are you aiming for, in a sense, a more of a timeless kind of approach, which seems to be at least part of the goal of this particular adaption?
I think we're gearing towards the timeless approach. So, I mean, one of the things, you know, 19th century women in the United States, particularly at a time when people would not be dressing fashionably or, you know, have the money to do that. But you know, if we were to compare European women, like if this were a British, you know, a Sense and Sensibility, we would be thinking about corsets and, you know, period movement. And a lot of that kind of goes by the wayside. So although we do have long skirts and, you know, men's jackets and top hats, we're really it is a much more sort of comfortable way of moving in that world. And the language is so contemporary. You know, an example of that is that the girls do a play for Christmas, and there's a little argument about what's happening in the play. And, you know, one of the lines that Jo says to her sister is, "There are no small roles, Amy, just small actors," which is something, you know, that is very contemporary. So I think to try to have any kind of period inflection with that language wouldn't make sense. So I hope it allows audiences to enter into the play in a way where they don't feel, oh, here we're seeing, you know, an old play of an old story, but we're seeing a story that's timeless in a very contemporary way, despite the fact that we're very aware by the furniture that's on the stage and the costumes and the things that are talked about that this is the 19th century.
Right. I remember from the recent film that we are in a whole lot of different locales. Is this stage adaption more tightly focused in the sense of where the action unfolds?
No, and in fact, this is the great challenge of this play is it has 26 scenes, and it moves from place to place. Sometimes time passes, sometimes it moves directly into a new location. So that is very challenging if you don't have huge amounts of money to create all kinds of ways of doing that. So we have a very open kind of abstract space that allows us to determine where we are, in part by the furniture and establishing locations, but also by the way the actors use that space. So that's a little challenging sometimes for audiences. It allows us, we still have to move things around, but it allows us to not have to spend an extra half an hour with scene changes where people in black come out and set the stage. So that's been fun and challenging. I think I often want to write to Kate Hamill and say, couldn't you have had maybe 10 locations or 10 scenes instead of 26? But that's very different than you could do this play just in the March household with walls. We have no walls. So there are symbolic elements within the set to help people to kind of think about how the setting connects to the themes. We'll see how people like that and how that works.
It sounds like a very logical and potentially really effective choice. I'm excited to see it. I want to give you an opportunity to talk about your cast, and I trust that it's been a great pleasure for you to work with them and that you feel good about the work that they have done.
Yeah, this is the first fully mounted play that I've done in 5 years, so it's been wonderful just to get back to rehearsal. And the first thing I have to say is I'm almost astonished at realizing when I've been in the rehearsal room how much I've missed that, how much I love working with actors. And I think the cast is terrific. Every single person is professional and is working hard. And, you know, it is community theater, so we have a wide range of experience with the actors. There are some people who have been in many shows and have, you know, we have some people in the cast who have just graduated from college from theater programs who really understand how to create a character, and other people who, you know, are learning as they go. But it's been a great cast. I wouldn't replace one of them. And just incredibly hardworking. I mean, it's a lot of time when you're, you know, everybody's working during the day and coming in at night. It's a challenging play. So I couldn't be happier with the cast, and I feel like they've really grown. It's hard material for all the reasons we've discussed. It's hard staging. I keep making changes. I have, you know, to get to this final point for opening, and as I said, I'm repeating myself, but I couldn't be happier.
Right. And given the technical challenges of this play, I'm remiss in not giving you a chance to acknowledge your crew, because, of course, that's one of the strengths of the Theater Guild, of course, it's a really wonderful space in which to work. And there are a lot of technical possibilities that I'm sure help make all of this possible.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of sound. You know, we had, as I said, 26 scenes with transitions. There are two pianos on stage, so people are playing the piano. So sound is very important. The set designer did a wonderful job of listening to what I was thinking about and creating this very open space and again, making changes or allowing us to make changes during the rehearsal process. Costumes, I think, are really a challenge unless you have a huge stock when you're working with period things. And we have Act One takes place, or Act Two, I should say, takes place 18 months after Act One. And we have young girls who are growing up. So, you know, we need to have changes. And yet we don't have a lot of time to make those changes and make full changes. So it's been, the designers have been great. The crew is great. Everybody was ready to go for opening night. Mm.
You can see the stage adaption of Little Women on the stage of the Racine Theater Guild for the next couple of weekends, and you can go to racinetheater.org or call the box office at 262-633-4218 for more information. At the helm of this production, guest director Lisa Konecki. Lisa Konecki, great to speak with you once again. Best wishes to you and everyone involved in this production of Little Women.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And in this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we are going to be talking about a grand celebration that is already underway by St. Mary's Lutheran Church on the south side of Kenosha, 2001 80th Street. I don't know why I have that address memorized, but I do. I guess I've just visited there enough times over the last 3.5 decades that I know exactly where St. Mary's Lutheran Church is. And it is in the midst of celebrating its 150th anniversary and doing so in splendid fashion with a number of different events, one of which has already taken place, namely what looked like a marvelous organ recital by Brian Schottler, a Carthage grad and someone who grew up at St. Mary's Lutheran and very happily came back to kick off this anniversary celebration. But there are other things going on at St. Mary's Lutheran, including a big concert this coming weekend. And we're going to be talking about the church's history and about the way in which it is commemorating this 150th anniversary with two people very busy with those plans. One of them is Pastor Debbie Hartfield, and the other, Dr. Richard Sjerdsma, who is, of course, a longtime former faculty colleague of mine at Carthage College and a longtime member of St. Mary's Lutheran Church, and for many, many years there, the choir director there. Are you the choir director there currently as well?
Yes.
So wearing that hat and also sitting on the committee that has helped to put plans together for this big anniversary. So we'll be talking about all of that and more over the next few minutes of today's morning show. We welcome both of you to our studios.
It's good to be here.
Good to see all of you. So, Pastor Hartfield, we could perhaps just begin with this whole matter of 150 years and what exists in order for you and others wanting to know the history of this congregation to explore it further. What kind of historical record exists that I presume you and others have been exploring over the last few months?
Absolutely. We've kind of unearthed a lot of archives that exist. There's commemorative booklets from 50 years, and every 25 years, therefore, you know, afterwards. So it's like we have 50 years, 75, 100 years, 125 year booklets.
Past celebrations.
Past celebrations, and of course, the official records of any church. But I think notably, Pastor Searsbeck left memoirs, and he was one of our pastors back in beginning in the 1950s, all the way through the early 80s. So it's been fun going through those documents and that history.
Wow. It's not often that a busy pastor has the time or takes the time to set down memoirs, as you say, but how valuable for you wanting to understand that portion of the church's history. By the way, how long have you been on the staff at St. Mary's?
Oh, about a year and a half.
Oh, so you're... Yeah. Caught up in all of this on rather short notice.
Yeah, but there's a backstory to that. I grew up in the church there.
Oh, this is your home church.
It's my home church.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
And Dr. Shearsman, I wanted to ask how long you have been a part of St. Mary's Lutheran Church. How far back does your legacy go?
I came to Kenosha in 1968 to begin my duties at Carthage, and at the same time, I was offered the position of church choir director at St. Mary's Lutheran, which I took, and my family grew up there. My girls were confirmed and the like, and I directed the choir for 25 years, and then my administrative plates at Carthage filled to overflowing, and I had to step back. And then upon the retirement of our music director, minister of music at that time, I was asked to resume, and so for the past, I think, 9 years already, I've been in my second iteration as choir director.
So time flies. And so you've been a part of this congregation for more than a third of its history.
Yeah, 56 years.
Wow, very good.
I make a point of stressing that, by the way.
I'm sure you love those big numbers. That's
yes.
Great. So Pastor Hartfield and Dr. Shearsman, feel free to chime in as you like. What can you tell us about the circumstances under which St. Mary's Lutheran Church first became a congregation 150 years ago, a long, long time ago?
Yeah, you know, it's a really kind of a fun story. Pastor Adam Dan was a pastor at Emmaus in the Racine area.
Yep, up on the north side.
Mm. Yep, and he was a newly ordained minister, and there was a group of Danish folk in Kenosha that were looking for somebody to preach and distribute the sacraments, and so they got a hold of Pastor Dan, and he came down, and I want to say it was like a year later, they asked him to come back again, and at that point, this small group of Danish folk had become serious about forming a church. And I don't know, I think we can laugh about this now, but apparently the story goes that Pastor Dan was in a controversy at his home congregation. And so the folks in Kenosha asked him if he would rather be in Kenosha and pastor them, and he said yes.
Escape the tumult.
Yes.
Funny how pastors and tumult can sometimes go together for all kinds of different reasons.
Right.
Yeah. So I did not remember that this is a congregation that is Danish in its background. And has that remained a really important part of its identity?
I mean, it's always part of your roots, but I don't think it's as much of our identity. I mean, we have all different backgrounds and nationalities and...
Right.
Yeah.
It was called the Danish Lutheran Church at first.
Yep.
Ah, it was
and,
in the name.
That was in 1874, and it didn't become St. Mary's until I think 1876.
Yeah, that, another interesting story. I think internally, yes. Legally, no.
Mm.
Legally, the documents have it at 1929. Which
oh, my.
Really, yeah, so on the records... When you look in 1929, but internally, yes, the name was changed way before then.
So they were thinking already expansively to allow in Dutch and other people that were not, didn't have the good fortune to be Danish.
Yeah, even Dutch.
Even the Dutch, very good.
I have to say, though, that for my first go-around as choir director, the Danish tradition was still very important, and my choir was heavily populated. Mm. With Danes, as Christmas parties and summer mm-hmm. picnics demonstrated.
And would you choose repertoire accordingly? I mean,
no.
Oh, some lines we don't cross.
And they were fine with that.
Sure,
yeah, yeah.
Sure.
But going back to Pastor Searsbeck, I mean, he's the one that we had spoken Danish services into the mid to late 50s.
Wow.
And then, you know. Decisions were made that
sure.
you know we should better speak English here.
Wow.
And yeah,
fascinating. So over the course of this 150 years, well, you've already touched on maybe a fairly momentous occasion in that century and a half worth of history. But can you think of a couple other moments in the congregation's history in which something especially important took place, or maybe some kind of different change in direction or something occurred? Or has it otherwise been a slow period of growth over those many years?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that question, everybody would answer that differently. Because everybody has different experiences within the church. Wow.
I think perhaps the growth that occurred in the 60s and 70s that resulted in the physical expansion of the church by about 40 feet to the north was an important milestone. And at the same time, well, it wasn't concurrent, but in that period too, we installed that stained glass area in the chancel with the four representations of Mary and the representations of the Holy Trinity as well by Eugene Potenti and his company. Mm-hmm. That was a milestone in our development, too.
Of course. Yeah, those are beautiful. And I remember Brian mentioning those stained glass windows in our interview about his organ recital, because mm-hmm. something about his repertoire, I think, was designed to reflect those beautiful windows. Mm-hmm. Very good. So I'm assuming when you began in the late 60s, the basic current structure was already there. That was St. Mary's Lutheran.
I remember one of the first things that then senior pastor Ray Peterson said to me on the day of my interview, when I entered the sanctuary and he met me there, I remarked about how unusual and beautiful I thought it was to have that A-frame architecture. And his response burned in my memory. Yes, isn't it worshipful? I never thought of that. But, you know, the apex pointing to the heavens.
Yeah, mm-hmm. very good. Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, we're talking about the 150th anniversary of St. Mary's Lutheran Church on the south side of Kenosha, 2001 80th Street. We're talking about that with Dr. Richard Seerdsma, who is the choir director there and has been a member of the congregation for over half a century. And also with us is Pastor Debbie Hartfield. And we are talking about the events that have been designed to celebrate this important occasion. So, Pastor Hartfield, tell us a bit about the way in which the celebration plans have taken place. And I'm guessing if you've only been the pastor there for a year and a half or so, that perhaps some of those plans were already underway at the time that you assumed your current position, or maybe not.
Certainly, I think it was on the minds of people. I think it didn't actively come together until this year. And you know, primarily, it's we're in a period of transition right now. So I'm part-time associate, and so we're seeking a full-time lead pastor at this point. So the people stepped up and organized, pretty much self-organized, I'll say, and put together plans, and people raised their hands to say, I'll lead that, and I'll take that, and it's been a wonderful in that way. One of the things I like to highlight, and it brings Carthage back into the conversation, is that we have two Carthage history interns that we've hired so that they will be doing, and are in the process right now as we speak, of doing oral interviews. And we'll be videotaping those, and we'll be making a production piece out of that and sharing that, as well as a written history.
Wow.
So we'll have a commemorative booklet to add to the collection that we have now.
What a fantastic idea.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. That's so great. What other things has your committee talked about kind of in the formation of this anniversary celebration? I mean, what sort of things were considered or thought to be important to include in such a celebration?
Yeah, I'll give an intro to Dick on that, because I think the history of St. Mary's is rich in music, just rich. It's always been part of the theology of that congregation is the music. And so Dick has taken lead on that and made sure that we had a commemorative piece completed across two very talented individuals, and we look forward to that and the music. And Dick, you can take it from here.
Well, one of the events that we have planned, had planned, has already taken place, and that's an organ recital by Brian Schottler, whom, as you mentioned, Greg, is the son of the congregation and a highly talented organist, composer, and church musician. He has an important position as a minister of music at, I think, a Methodist church in Evanston. But the next event on Sunday, November 3 at 2 o'clock will be a celebratory concert featuring music groups from the church. The concert will begin with a set of numbers by the Jubilate Ringers, our bell choir. It will continue with a few selections by our praise team, and then the adult choir will present, as kind of a centerpiece to the concert, four anthems that are targeted to each of the Marian representations in the stained glass windows. We talked about that a bit earlier. Each of those anthems will be preceded by a scripture passage, which will be read by a former pastor from the church. So we have Pastor George Carlson and his wife Solveig, who will read, Pastor Kathy Bodwine, Pastor Cindy Assen from St. Paul's Lutheran, and also our former associate pastor, Sheila Ron. So we will involve a lot of history there as well. If I may include an interesting antidote, well, I guess whether it's interesting or not would be for others to determine. We have four Marian representations in our stained glass windows: the Annunciation, the Birth, the Crucifixion, and then what I had always assumed was the Resurrection. That last stained glass window depicts three women in a rather triangular pyramidal formation, and above them appears to be stained glass windows, which stained glass flames of fire, which I only recently noticed. And I had planned on it being a resurrection representation and had chosen my music accordingly. And suddenly I thought, that is not resurrection at all. I wonder if that is ascension. So I went back to some of the old documents, and in a previous booklet, I found that that Potente had indicated that represents three women in the upper room following the ascension. So I scrambled quickly to find a new piece, and I think my hair got a bit grayer.
Right. At that point. The moral of the story is look closely at your stained glass windows and don't jump to conclusions. Well, glad that things were rectified and everything is as it is to be. So that will be this coming Sunday, November 3rd at 2 o'clock in the sanctuary of St. Mary's Lutheran Church.
May I add one more thing?
Yeah.
We had, thanks to the a grant from the St. Mary's Foundation, it commissioned a new hymn to be written for the occasion. And I was I contacted Brian Schottler to compose the music, and he had offered me a slate of hymn writers, poets, for the text, and I selected one And the text is written by Reverend Martin Zeltz from the Minneapolis area. And that text is just stunning. In four verses, he incorporates the future of hope theme of our anniversary celebration, the brief mission statement of St. Mary's, pray, love, and serve. He mentions the promise that Mary received upon the Annunciation, and the hymn title is Singing Promise on the Way. And then that was subsequently set to music by Brian, and we will premiere that and sing it, the congregation as well, at the concert on the 3rd.
Wow, what a great idea, and what a beautiful way to commemorate this special moment and to also send the congregation into its future. Just love that. So this coming Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, the concert that Dr. Schertzma has just been describing. Pastor Hartfield, are there other events that are going to be going on to continue this celebration? I mean, sometimes churches will party on for a good calendar year when the occasion is momentous as this one.
Yeah, I hope that's the case. I absolutely hope that's the case, and that we can continue that celebration. We'll have a culminating worship service on the 24th of November with our bishop as our guest preacher, and we'll have full worship and praise that day for being thankful for God's faithfulness with St. Mary's for 150 years.
Very good. Yes, you only turn 150 once, I'm pretty sure. So,
yes. So
it's something that should be celebrated with all the bells and whistles one can summon, and
yep. It
sounds like that's exactly what is going to be the case. Dr. Schertzman, maybe you could just recap for our listeners what is going to be part of this concert coming up on Sunday afternoon and what people should do if they would like to attend.
It's free and open to the public, and it will just be an overview of the musical wealth of our congregation, and a celebration of what we've been given for 150 years. It will be bells, no whistles, as far as I know, unless the congregation gets rowdy.
Right.
Yeah.
It'll feature the bells, our praise choir, the adult choir. Brian will also offer a voluntary on the Magnificat as an organ solo in the middle, and then the introduction of our commissioned hymn to conclude.
Fantastic. Sounds like a wonderful festive occasion that we hope a lot of people will take the opportunity to experience in person. Again, that is this Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock at St. Mary's Lutheran Church, 2001 80th Street. And by the way, they have a very colorful website that has a whole lot of information there about other aspects of the congregation and of the celebration. Pastor Hartfield, is there anything else we need to cover?
No, I think that's it. All are welcome, and we give thanks for everybody's effort and work and bringing this together and ongoing celebration.
Very good. Pastor Debbie Hartfield and Dr. Richard Schertzma, great to have both of you here. Happy anniversary to you and all the other good folks at St. Mary's Lutheran Church.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you.
It is 8:59 at WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. We will join Wisconsin Public Radio for the Wisconsin Today Show in just a little bit. Let's give you the weather forecast. The details from the National Weather Service right now. Today should be sunny and seasonal, a high of 51, normal high this time of year 55. And the record high, by the way, was 77. That was first set on November 1st, 1944, equal to 1950. then again in 2016. Tonight, sunset 5:43, clear and cold, 35 for the low. Saturday, sunny and 60. Sunday, rain and 63. Now 40 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha as we come up on 9 o'clock.